Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? It's the question college grads are asking this month, or perhaps have been asking and obsessing for a few years now. It's also the question many adults are still asking long after the cap and gown are folded into the archival box. Dave Evans is on a mission to help others find theirs. He's worked as a tech executive with startup executive teams, with corporate clients, and with college students. He taught a course for 8 years at UC Berkeley called How to Find Your Vocation. Now he has co-written a book with Bill Burnett that's called Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life. He joins us now on the phone from Santa Cruz, California. Dave Evans, welcome to In the Moment.
Lori, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the course first and how you sort of came upon the idea that college kids needed, an elective option for what comes after college.
Well, it all started a long time ago when I was a college sophomore myself, and I couldn't figure out what to do. And when I noticed the university was teaching me lots of things that I might be able to do with my life, but they weren't teaching me anything about how to figure my life out. And when I went to them for help, frankly, they were of no help at all. And then I noticed other people didn't know how to do this thing either. So I got into my career, fell into high tech early on. And in the early days in Silicon Valley, you know, we worked on a thing called corporate culture. I was on the first corporate culture committee at Apple Computer back in the 70s and 80s. At Electronic Arts, where I was a co-founder, we wrote the manifesto of the company before we wrote the business plan, because it was all about what are we doing for the people who work here and what are they doing for the people we're serving. Everyone has this question about what their life means to them, and a lot of people struggle with it. So then as years go by, I got invited to teach at Cal and then came over to Stanford in 2007 when my friend Bill Burnett took on the new position as the executive director of the design program. I said, hey, Bill, you know, these students are really struggling. They have been forever, and colleges are doing a lousy job of helping them with this question. We ought to use design thinking to assist our students in figuring out what they want to do to get started. He said, great idea. Let's go. And that's how this thing got started. So we've been teaching at Stanford for 10 years now. And what's become, in fact, a pretty big deal with learning how to use design thinking to design your life. And it applies when you're in college, but it actually applies to anybody who thinks the rest of their life is interesting and they haven't got it all figured out yet, which we're finding is just about everybody.
Can you define design thinking? What is design thinking?
Well, the best way to start defining design thinking is to define what it's not. There are lots of different ways to think. We use engineering thinking, you know, with well understood problems and lots of equations, and you can technically get the right answer. We use business thinking to optimize how to respond to markets. You know, we use analytic or research thinking to come up with new science or new ideas in the research university. And design thinking is a different technique of thinking. It's a series of steps. When you know you don't have the answer, you're not exactly sure where you're going or exactly sure what it is we're trying to do for people. So we have to come up with a bunch of ideas and then take those ideas and prototype them really quickly to get real feedback from real people out in the empirical world, and then iterate that prototype process to innovate a new solution that will really work, which is why we call it human-centered design, or design thinking, is building things in a human way that really works for human people. So that's what design thinking is about, and that has been used to innovate lots of products, and now we're helping people use it to innovate their own lives.
So can you define, not to get too stuck on definitions, but can you define a well-designed life? And does that definition sort of change throughout life?
Well, again, design, when we say design, if I designed it, like I got it just right, I designed it just perfectly. And that's not that would be an engineered solution. You know, there's just an exact right answer. So a well-designed life is one that's lived into creatively, you know, and honestly, and trying to come up with something that will actually work in the real world. And of course, is going to evolve as we continue to pursue the changing environment we live in. So if people are going to grow, and we think people do, then the well-designed life is one that's constantly responding to what's happening in the world and what's happening in you. The only person who can assess whether or not your life is well-designed is you. And what we're just trying to do is give people some ideas and some tools that give them the approach to doing that intentionally. So they don't either have to like make it up all right out of the box, or they don't have to sort of, you know, blindly bludgeon their way through the dark by hand. So in between that is an effective method of making it up as you go along. The truth is we're all making it up as we go along because none of us knows the future yet, but you can become very competent at the process of making it up as you go along.
I'm looking at the introduction of the book, and it says only 27% of college grads end up in a career that is related to their majors. Is that a problem, an opportunity, or, you know, something you'd like to adjust?
Well, first of all, it's just true. When, you know, the whole thing, you know, you're about to graduate, and what'd you major in? Oh, I majored in linguistics. Oh, and then the question is immediately, what are you going to do with that? And the problem is all questions have a belief system. And the belief of the question, what are you going to do with that major? What are you going to do with that degree you just got? Is the assumption that it believes that your degree determines the future. And it doesn't. There are only 65 undergraduate majors at Stanford. There are 7 billion people in the world. There are more than 65 things that people do. The question, what are you going to do with that, is a dumb question. Because, I mean, there are hundreds of things I could do with a linguistics degree. In fact, it doesn't even mean I'm doing a linguistics degree. And the fact that, you know, 7 to 8 out of 10 people within some years after graduation are working outside what they studied doesn't mean they studied the wrong thing. What it means is life is a whole lot bigger than your bachelor's degree. So the way we respond to that statistic is, of course, you know, people are much bigger than what the undergraduate choices available in the world are. And there's more reasons to go to college than just figuring out what your first job wants to be.
Right. What's the question we should be asking recent graduates, high school graduates, college graduates? You know, so often you have open house after open house after open house. You want to say, you know, what's next? What do you want to be when you grow up? But that's the wrong question, you say. What should we be asking young adults as they move to the next stage?
So it's really, we talk about curating your curiosity. You know, you don't necessarily know the answer. You know, the common question, what's your passion, is very popular right now. Well, look, 8 out of 10 times people either don't know their passion or have more than one. So there isn't a single answer. So what we say is, you know, a passion is more the outcome of the well-lived life than the input to it. And statistics will show people grow passions by doing interesting work. How about starting with, you know, what's going on in the world that's interesting you? You know, what wakes you up in the night? What do you think is interesting enough you'd like to explore and learn more about? You know, 5 years from now, if you could have learned something and done something, what might that be? So these are the kind of questions that help people start into the iterative process of growing their adult lives, rather than questions that start assuming, hey, you're 19, you should have it all figured out. I mean, I'm 64 now, and I'm pretty sure my 19 to 21-year-old self is not the first guy I would ask about what the best thing to do the next 40 years of my life is. I might ask that person what to do the next 5 years of my life, and then my 24-year-old was a lot better at it than my 19-year-old, and I got to tell you, my 64-year-old self is a whole lot better at this than even my 45-year-old self was. We're supposed to be getting better, so let's just do this thing one step at a time.
So did you sort of stumble into those progressions, or were you applying some of the skills that you teach now in workshops through this book and to college students in your own life and seeing them work?
Oh, no. Unfortunately, my own pathway is a wonderful example of exactly what not to do. I did this as inefficiently and as difficultly as you possibly can. So in many ways, the work that Bill and I do together has grown out of the wounds that I suffered that don't need to be repeated. I got bad counsel in college. I wasted a lot of time. I tried things and failed much worse than I had to. I mean, trial and error is part of the program for sure, but I did this much more inefficiently than I could have. I would have been very well served by taking the class in college that we now teach. And that's frankly a big part of the reason we teach it.
All right. So let's break down into the class and into the book a little bit, some of the details. Where do you start?
Well, when asked for just give us the one sentence version, and we eschew things that are that oversimplified, but if forced to, we would say, okay, get curious, talk to people, and try stuff. So if you want literally the three basic steps, and boil this thing down to a nutshell, get curious, talk to people, and try stuff. What does that mean? It means by getting curious, we start with where the energy in you is going to move you out into the world. You know, don't start with a strategic thing, and even necessarily the most lucrative thing. You want it to be viable, but, you know, we got to start with something where there's some energy in it. And then before you go ask for the job, or you go get the graduate degree, or you move to the new city, go talk to people. Have lots of conversations with people who are living the life that you're imagining you might want to be stepping into. We call these life design prototype conversations. And these conversations are essentially little time machines. The future that you're imagining or wondering about, somebody is already living some version of today. So let's go find those people and say, hey, tell me what it's like to be you. What's it like to be a Lori? Tell me how you got to do that. The same kind of questions you're asking me. And people love telling their story. If you do that a bunch of times, you start getting better informed and you'll notice which things are animating you and pulling you forward and which things are kind of going not so much. So that's how you get started. And then you move from talking to people to trying things, little projects, little ride-alongs, actual experiences, not just conversations, but experiences on the way to figuring out what versions of life you want to actually engage.
You've got an interesting section in the book. And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Dave Evans. He's the author with Bill Burnett of a book called Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life. And, you know, Dave, it's a well-designed book, too, I have to say. It's some really smart book design there. And what I'm wondering is, as the course unfolded, you know, how did you know it was working? For the students who were taking it, how do you know the methodology was solid?
Well, you know, we teach design, so pretty much we're obligated to use design thinking, which means we need to start with empathy and need finding, talk to the user, make sure that we're actually responding to where people are really coming from, have a bunch of ideas, then prototype them. So literally, Bill and I had lunch in the spring of 2007 and hatched this idea. And the first thing we said, we got to prototype it. So that summer, we put together a handful of little exercises, none of which we use anymore, by the way. They've all been designed out. And we got 8 former students, 4 undergrad students, 4 graduate students who are now working out in the world, you know, in their mid-late 20s, to come back and talk with us on 2 Wednesday evenings. And we ran these little exercises with these 8 students and said, which ones work, what's interesting, what's not. And we're looking for their feedback. So we're constantly using user feedback. And on the second evening of that very first prototype session back in the summer of 2007, it was 10 o'clock at night. You know, we did the second 2-hour session. We said, well, great, guys. Thanks for coming. We really appreciate you giving us a little of your time. And one of the young men slammed his hand down on the table. Bam! And he goes, we're not going anywhere. We go, what? No, I think we are. We're done. We don't have any more ideas. And they go, we have no place to have this conversation. We're not done talking about this stuff. We're not going anywhere. And we stayed till midnight. And we heard that phrase, we have no place to have this conversation, over and over again. So the feedback we've had from our clients, from our students, from our collaborators, has been the thing that has guided us. And all the exercises and all the ideas in the book have been iterated and modified dozens and dozens and dozens of times. You know, we've taught thousands of students now. Some of our exercises we have reworked over 50 or 60 times. And 2 PhD studies evaluating the efficacy of our pedagogical intervention. So this is pretty, it's simple stuff, but it's thoroughly refined stuff.
So how do you use the book then? You must use that in some sort of community and with intentionality.
You know, when I actually dragged my feet on writing the book for 2 years because I wasn't sure a book all by itself would be enough to help people. And we've had wonderful feedback that fortunately it is. And, you know, people are bringing a lot of energy to the question because people care about their lives. And if you want to just sit down and read the book, and by the way, it's not the system of like do these 5 steps in exactly this way and boom, you'll suddenly know the answer. It doesn't work like that. It's a bunch of ideas and a bunch of tools in a toolkit. And you can use them in any order that works for you. So you're a smart person. You're in charge. You know, Lori knows a lot more about Lori than I do. And so you can use these tools in the appropriate way. So if you want to use the book all by itself, you can get there. It's a lot more effective, we think, if you can get a team of people supporting you, at least a couple of friends or colleagues who you could get together with for dinner, you know, now and then, where you just share the ideas and the insights you're learning by reading these ideas and doing the exercises and have them be a feedback loop for you, that would be great. And the best thing would be, let's get a couple of people together, you know, 4, 5, 6 people. And what if we're all doing this together? Each one of us is kind of going through a life design project and sharing back and forth what our different ideas are and our different experiences are. That's the way we teach our class. It's very easy to do that with a collection of people. We've, in fact, our digital communities manager on our website, there are hundreds of digital communities and even people in the same geographies who are getting together and conversing about the ideas in the book communally, and hearing the conversation together really helps a lot. So we really encourage people to do this in a group if they can.
So for a recent graduate or someone who's looking at graduating, do you find other people who are at the same age as you? Can families do this together, or is maybe your parents not the best person to include in that conversation? What are your thoughts?
Well, the first thing you're looking for are people who are on the same page, who are teachable and growable and are willing to give this design thinking approach a try and are willing to be honest and trustworthy to each other. Now, if that includes mom and dad, great. If that doesn't include mom and dad, well, then let's go get some other people. You know, it depends on the family. We have been working now with alumni groups at Stanford and with corporate groups and what have you. So wide ranges of age and circumstance and even career path. And very diverse groups can do fine. We've had small groups of people where, you know, two 20-year-olds, you know, two 50-something-year-olds and an 80-year-old guy, you know, and somebody's niece. And if we're in the right structured conversation, that can work just fine. You don't need people just like you. You don't need people in the same industry, and you don't need people the same age. Now, let's say you're 22, you know, or you're 45, and you're right at that point in your career where, you know, how did I get here for the first time? So if you want the empathy of people suffering in the same moment that you are, then fine. Go ahead and let's get a bunch of college grads together. Let's get a bunch of mid-career people together. Let's get a bunch of working moms together. You know, there's sometimes that shared experience can be really encouraging. So all those flavors work, and you're the expert. So the individual, I mean, what's going to serve you? What do you need? We'd have almost no rules about that stuff other than, you know, look for people you trust and can be generative, not critical.
Yeah. I like the empathy of suffering people in the same moment. That's well said. What is a gravity problem? This is another interesting area in the book where you sort of define, you know, what's possible and maybe what you want to call a gravity problem. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, a big part of what we're trying to do is help people get unstuck. People are stuck, and there's lots of ways to get stuck. And a gravity problem is a very common way that people get stuck. And we named it that. That's a metaphoric name. You know, I happen to be a cyclist. I ride bicycles and have for a long, long time. And, you know, in addition to getting a little older, I'm getting a little bigger, particularly around the middle. I'm getting a little heavier. And I've got this problem, Lori, which is, you know, going up hills is a lot harder than it used to be. It's this gravity thing. It's literally really weighing me down. I can't stand it. I don't know what to do about it. I've got to solve this gravity problem. Can you help me? And of course, the answer is, well, no, Dave, there's nothing you can do about gravity. You know, and so very often people are finding themselves struggling with, for a long time, very unhappily, a quote problem, which is in fact something you can't do anything about. I mean, we can't change gravity. You know, I'm struggling. I'd like to get into medicine, but, you know, it takes so long to get trained. I don't know what to do about that problem. Well, that's not actually a problem you can solve. It's just a circumstance. So what you do with the gravity problem is the first thing is you accept it. Okay, it takes 8 years to become an MD in this culture. Wow, that's really a big deal. But and the first thing is disappointment, like, wow, that's awful to have to accept. But now I'm freed by that acceptance to do what I can do. Well, is there some way that I could actually survive that process? I just had a meeting with a 56-year-old woman who is starting off to med school. You know, and she just owned the reality of what that's going to cost her, you know, and she fully expects to be healthy well into her 80s. So I'm not going to start practicing until I'm 64 years old. And that's okay with me. So she's freed herself by accepting the problem she can have and not getting stuck on the problem there really isn't one. If it's not actionable, it's not a problem. It's just a circumstance. It may be a crummy one, but it's just a fact, and there's no reason to fight reality. Reality always wins that fight. So gravity problems are situations that warrant an acceptance, a reframe, and then a new problem I can actually act on.
What's reframing?
That's,
you said
reframing
acceptance and then a reframe, yeah.
Differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reframe, in the case of just said, gosh, my problem is, you know, med school takes too long.
Right.
You know, then you go, no, there's not too long. It's just as long as it is. So the acceptance is med school takes 8 years. And so the reframe isn't, how do I get over the 8-year problem? The reframed question is, how can I support myself while going to med school at the age of 56 for the next 8 years?
Hmm.
And that's tricky. It may involve loans, may involve changing the way I live. But the reframe is, how do I survive, you know, with my adult kids, you know, getting from 56 to 64 while going to medical school?
Never too late, never too early.
That's a reframe. That's right. It's just now. It's now o'clock again.
It's now o'clock.
A friend of mine used to not wear a watch. He had a rubber band on his arm where most people wear a watch. And people would say, hey, John, what time is it? And he'd stick his arm out, and he'd grab the rubber band, and he would snap it on his arm. And he'd go, ow, oh, it's now o'clock again. You know, so it's always now a clock. You're not late. You're not early. It's just now. What are we going to do now?
So let's just talk for a second about not being too early, though. So high school students, you think this sort of process is accessible to them as they sort of plan what they might want to do after getting out of, you know, sort of compulsory education?
Well, sure. We get a lot of questions. We've not spent a lot of time working with high schoolers yet, but we're getting a lot of inquiries about that. And now in terms of too early, I mean, we're pretty sure it's never too late. There are some things you could be too early for. You know, if I'm talking to somebody in sixth grade, they're saying, gee, who should I marry? Well, you know, that's probably too early. You know, we probably don't need to talk about it yet. You know, so we want to have things in their time. And so if I'm in high school, you know, the key thing to do with a high schooler is to be asking different questions. So the question isn't, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or what are you going to major in? Or, you know, as opposed to like, well, what are you interested in learning? Or, you know, when you think about different ways you could live, which ones come to mind? The best thing we can do for high schoolers is start acting like the truth is you don't know who you want to be yet. I mean, I sit down with Stanford MBA students, incoming Stanford MBA students, and the number one most exclusive, you know, business school in the country. These are really, really sharp people, theoretically incredibly directed. You know, they're mostly 3 to 5 years into their career. They're 25 to 30 years old. I mean, you know, this is like, get out of my way, here I come kind of people. And I'll stand in front of 400 of these guys and go, look, how many of you are hoping that you're doing something 10 years from today that we can't even talk about because what you're doing 10 years from today, nobody's doing now. It doesn't even exist yet. And 3/4 of the room raises their hand. We all want to live into a future that nobody has imagined yet. Well, go all the way back to a 16 or an 18-year-old in high school and say, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to live in the world of 2040 when things are entirely different, and I'm pretty sure we have jet cars. So rather than lie to them by asking a question that assumes they deserve to know a future that no one knows, right? It's a question that presupposes a falsehood. Let's ask a question that matches who they are. You're a young person who could be lots of different people. What are a couple of versions of you that you'd like to try on before you become a grown up?
But can you teach the design thinking principles to younger students? The principles of design,
you know,
that way that they can apply to other things as they grow. Then,
sure you can. Absolutely, sure. We do. I mean, the D School, the Institute of Design at Stanford, you know, does boot camps for kids all the time. This stuff's being incorporated into some leading pedagogies in junior highs and high schools around the country. Design thinking itself is really very simple. You know, the five steps are empathy, definition, ideation, prototyping, and test. So empathy simply means really understand what's going on. Before you make a judgment about what you're going to do, just go find out what's going on. Have an open mind. Then define what your question is. You don't problem solve until you problem find. You know, let's say you're working on your science project as a junior higher. Well, you know, go learn a lot of stuff about what's going on in the solar system and then decide what about the solar system would you like your project to be about. Don't start with the problem. Start with curiosity. Then figure out what problem is worth solving. Then try, have a bunch of ideas, try some prototypes. Those steps are really very simple and kids really can get them. And you don't even have, as the parents and teachers who are guiding young people, you don't even have to teach them the design theory before they can think like that. Just start changing the way you interact with kids and asking them different questions that lean into curiosity, trial and error, and growing rather than get it right the first time. You know, because most of life is not about get it right the first time.
Ken, I'll just ask you one more question because I know you have probably a busy day, but
sure.
Fascinating stuff, Dave. How about applying design thinking to real-life situations that are outside your own life, politics, poverty, crime? Is there a correlation there?
Absolutely. What we're finding, that in addition to the design program at Stanford, the 57-year-old department that I work in, which is the one where you get an undergraduate or a graduate degree in design, we also have the Design Institute at Stanford, known as the D School, the Hauser Plattner Institute for Design. And one of its missions is to, you know, assist the world in applying design thinking in all kinds of new spheres. And so applying it in education, applying it in developing world economies. There's a famous class at Stanford for graduate students called Design for Extreme Affordability. And they go and they find real problems in the developing world, you know, and how could design thinking actually come up with a new solution? In fact, my eldest son, when he actually was getting his graduate degree in design, my son is a designer, he went to Africa to where the ovens that people use to cook food break all the time, and they're running out of the materials they make these ovens out of. And so they worked with villagers and used the design thinking process to redesign what these ovens look like so that people wouldn't have to spend so much time, you know, fixing these things or finding new firewood because the ovens weren't very effective. All kinds of solutions in all kinds of different places, the design thinking process can make an impact on social issues, educational issues. Lots of people are making lots of progress on all these wicked problems. Anytime it's a human, messy problem, and we know we don't know what we're doing, then the prototype iteration and ideation tools of design thinking can be an effective way to innovate our way forward.
Dave Evans is co-author of Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life. The hardcover is available today. Dave, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Take care.